Pauta pandemia.
Testing, 1, 2, 3. Testing. Test. Testing, 1, 2, 3. Okay. Namo. Okay, we have been studying the Vatthupama Sutta. This is Sutta number 7 in the Majjhima Nikaya. And last time, it was quite a few weeks ago, we went through the 16 mental defilements mentioned in the sutta. And then I explained the three ways of abandoning defilements, just to go over those again. One is through temporary, what's called abandoning in a particular respect, or temporary abandoning of defilements. And this is the kind of abandoning that takes place when one develops a particular quality that is exactly opposed to a particular defilement. For example, it says that one develops the meditation on the unattractive nature of the body to overcome sensual lust, or one develops the meditation on loving kindness to overcome hatred, anger, ill will. And also, just when one notices a defilement arise, and then one makes an effort, one applies energy just to remove that defilement from the mind and to bring the mind back to a state of clarity. So this temporary effort to remove the defilement, this is the first type of abandoning, the abandoning in a particular respect. The second kind is abandoning by suppression, and this is what occurs through the achievement of deep samadhi, particularly the attainment of the jhanas, the meditative absorptions, when the mind becomes completely absorbed in the meditation object, and then the defilements don't appear at all. And then through the power of the deep samadhi, even when one comes out of the samadhi back to normal consciousness, through the continuing power, the residual power of the samadhi, the defilements remain in a state of quiescence or suspension. So that some who master the samadhis could even think that they have achieved arahatship, that they've completely eradicated all of the defilements. And then the third way of eliminating or abandoning the defilements is called eradication, abandonment through eradication. And this is the stage where one completely cuts off the defilement, even at the root, so that it can never arise again. And this is the kind of abandoning that takes place when one develops panya, or wisdom, and one cultivates this wisdom until it reaches the level of the Lokuttara Magga. This is the world transcending or supramundane path realization. And the sheet that I gave out last time, the handout, related the 16 defilements of the discourse on the simile of the cloth to the four stages of attainment, the four stages of awakening or liberation. So on the second side of that page, we explain that this is according to the method of the commentaries, which is in turn based on the Abhidhamma. The path of stream entry eliminates six of these defilements: contempt, insolence, envy, miserliness, deceit, and craftiness. Then the second stage of enlightenment, the stage of the once returner, doesn't eliminate any new defilements. So the next stage, this path of the non-returner, eliminates four defilements, that is ill will, anger, hostility, and heedlessness. Heedlessness being understood here as, let's say, sensual craving, sensual desire. That's the way it's explained by the commentary. And then the path of arhatship eliminates six of the defilements: covetousness and unrighteous greed, which are taken together as one; obstinacy, rivalry, conceit, arrogance, and vanity. Then last time I also explained my own questioning of some of these stipulations in the commentary. To me, I haven't found any sutta text that says that the path of stream entry eliminates these six defilements. And the statement in the commentary that the path of non-returner eliminates pamada, or heedlessness, is based on identifying heedlessness with, basically, with sensual craving or sensual desire. But if we take heedlessness in the more general sense as a kind of negligence in eliminating defilements from the mind whenever they arise, then it would seem to me that heedlessness is eliminated only at the fourth stage with the attainment of arhatship. Okay, before I go on, I'll ask whether there are any questions left over from last time. Yes, please.
So the last statement that you're saying is that all through the three first stages...
Wait, better to take the microphone.
Can arise but your vigilance is off. So it's still not 100% perfect.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And then at the end, the last stage is where it's totally fine-tuned, and every unwholesome state that comes up, you're totally aware of it.
At the last stage?
Yeah.
At the last stage, all of the defilements are cut off permanently, so unwholesome states don't even arise at all. Okay, so let me go further. Let us go further into the text. Okay, so what we've covered so far in the sutta takes us through section number 4, knowing that covetousness and unrighteous greed and so on is an imperfection that defiles the mind. The bhikkhu abandons it. And so this is repeated for each of the other defilements. Okay, so now we come to paragraph number 5. Okay, when a bhikkhu has known that covetousness and unrighteous greed is an imperfection that defiles the mind, or a defilement of the mind, and has abandoned it, when he has known that all of the others are imperfections that defile the mind, and has abandoned it, he acquires unwavering confidence in the Buddha thus. Okay, here the text uses a very specific expression, or an expression that has a very specific meaning within the framework of early Buddhist doctrine. This is the expression that's translated unwavering confidence. In Pali, this is in Pali, this is called avecha pasada. The word pasada is what's translated as confidence. The word implies a kind of settling of the mind, a pacification or settling down of the mind. And it's usually used to signify the kind of attitude that one person has towards another person in whom he has confidence or trust. And so if somebody sees, for example, somebody who's a devout Buddhist sees a very pleasing statue or image of the Buddha, there will arise in the mind a kind of attitude of pasada, which is trust, confidence, accompanied by a feeling of peacefulness, and the mind settles down and becomes calm and composed. And now this word pasada is qualified by the expression avecha, which means, literally it means having undergone or having experienced. So what this means is the confidence that arises based upon some degree of experiential realization of the truth of the Dhamma. And so this is used in the text as a technical expression for the confidence that a noble disciple has, especially in the Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha. So this is the confidence that sets into the mind with the attainment of the first stage of enlightenment, the stage of sotapatti or stream entry. Up to that point, one can have simply pasada, confidence or trust in the Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha. But it's with the attainment of stream entry that one sees the truth of the teaching, that one sees into the ultimate Dhamma. And so at that point, one has undergone the experience of seeing the truth of the Dhamma. And then there arises confidence in the Triple Gem based on that experiential realization of the truth. And in the text, we find occasional mention of four factors of stream entry. These are four factors that qualify a person as a stream enterer. And the first three of these are unwavering confidence in the Buddha, in the Dhamma, and in the Aryan Sangha, the community of the noble ones. And the fourth is a firm commitment to observance of the five precepts. It's said that the noble disciple is possessed of those virtues or those types of virtuous conduct which are dear to the noble ones, unbroken, unblemished, uncorrupted, and so on. Okay, so in paragraph 5, the text is describing this monk who has, to some extent, abandoned these defilements of the mind, describing such a one as at least a stream enterer. Okay, so it says that when the monk has known that these are the defilements of the mind and has abandoned them, then he acquires unwavering confidence in the Buddha thus. And then this is followed by the 9 epithets or 9 special qualities of the Buddha. So the Blessed One is, first, he is an accomplished one. The actual Pali word here is arahang. Itibiso Bhagava Arahant. So the Buddha is, first of all, he's an arahant, which means that he is one who has completely eradicated all defilements and achieved complete liberation from the cycle of samsara, the cycle of birth and death. Then beyond being an arahant, he's one who is perfectly or fully enlightened, one who understands fully all of the truths or principles of the Dhamma. He is one who has acquired true knowledge or higher knowledge and virtuous conduct, so that all aspects of his conduct are praiseworthy, upright, dignified. The next word is sukato, very difficult to translate exactly into English. It means literally well gone, and it's explained to mean that he has gone along the good path, that's the Noble Eightfold Path, and he's gone to the good goal, which is the attainment of Nibbana. He is the knower of the world, the incomparable, or better, unsurpassed leader or trainer of persons to be tamed, the teacher of the gods, these are the devas, and human beings, the enlightened one and the blessed one, the one who possesses excellent, outstanding virtues. Okay, then he acquires unwavering confidence in the Dhamma, that the Dhamma is well proclaimed, well taught, well expounded by the Buddha, that it's visible here and now in this very life, that it's immediately effective, that as one practices, one can gain the benefits in this very life, that it's inviting inspection, that is, it calls upon one to examine it, to put it into practice, and to see the benefits for oneself. It leads onward, and it's to be experienced by the wise for themselves. So here, under the Dhamma that he has confidence in, we actually have three aspects of the Dhamma. One is the Dhamma as the teaching, the Dhamma that's expounded. So that's the Dhamma which is said to be well proclaimed. Then there's the Dhamma as the path of practice. This is what is signified by visible here and now, immediately effective, inviting inspection, and leading onward. And then there's Dhamma as the goal, the ultimate goal, and that is the Dhamma that's to be experienced by the wise for themselves. Okay, then next he has unwavering confidence in the Sangha. And here what's meant by the Sangha is not necessarily the monastic order. We say that the monastic order, the order of fully ordained monks and nuns, is, I would call it, the visible representation of the Sangha. But the actual Sangha, which is the third refuge and the third jewel, is not the monastic order, but it is the spiritual community of those who have realized the truth of the Buddha's teaching. This is the community of the noble persons. So it's said that the Sangha of the Blessed One's disciples is practicing the good way, practicing the straight way, practicing the true way or the effective way, practicing the proper way. Then comes the specification of who is the Sangha of the Buddha's disciples. It's the four pairs of persons, the eight types of individuals that it is. Okay, this means it's the four pairs of persons, that is, the stream enterer, the once returner, the non-returner, and the arahat. And those who have entered on the irreversible paths leading to those four stages of attainment. So we take for each type of person, there is the path attainer and the one who has reached the fruit of the path or the goal of the path. So in this way, we have four pairs of persons or eight individuals. And then it said, this Sangha of the Blessed One's disciples is worthy of gifts, worthy of hospitality, worthy of offerings, worthy of reverential salutation. That is what is called in Pali, it's called Anjali, which is putting the hands, the palms of the hands together and then bowing the head. The unsurpassed field of merit for the world. So making gifts and offerings to the Aryan Sangha generates great amount of punya, merit or wholesome karma that leads to one's well-being and happiness in life after life. Okay, so these are the first three factors of stream entry, or the disciples at each of the higher stages also have these three types of unwavering confidence. Okay, so when the Buddha speaks about this disciple as acquiring the three types of unwavering confidence, it signifies that this disciple is now at least a stream enterer, but he could also be once returner or non-returner. But in this context, not yet an arhat. Okay, we could see this from the next section in the sutta. He goes on to say, when he has given up, expelled, released, abandoned, and relinquished, that is, these defilements of the mind, to some extent, or in part. The text uses actually a rather rare expression, which the expression it uses is indicated in note number 90. In Pali it reads, yat odi, which means up to a certain limit, but not yet completely. So in other words, the text is suggesting that the disciple has eliminated these defilements partly, but not yet totally and completely. And we'll see that the disciple still has further work to do in order to reach the goal. Okay, so when he has eliminated these defilements in part, then he reflects back on his achievement, especially acquiring this unwavering confidence in the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha. And so when he reflects back first on his unwavering confidence in the Buddha, then he gains, here we have an expression I've translated, he gains inspiration in the meaning, he gains inspiration in the Dhamma. He gains gladness connected with the Dhamma. Okay, the Pali for this term the Pali for this expression that's translated inspiration in the meaning, this is attaveda, and inspiration in the Dhamma is Dhammaveda. Now this word Veda, of course, has a very important meaning in the context of Indian spirituality. This was the word that the Brahmins used to signify their collections of sacred texts, sacred scriptures. They call them the Vedas. And so these are the hymns and verses and poems that the very early Brahmins had composed and preserved in a very old form of Sanskrit called Vedic Sanskrit. It's a very beautiful language. But the word Veda itself is related to it's based on the root vid, which means both to know and to feel. So the word Veda combines these two, we can say it has two facets. It's a kind of knowledge which is accompanied by an elevated feeling. And it's a feeling which is accompanied by knowledge. And so the word inspiration here, it's not really so adequate, but it's almost impossible to find an English word which is able to unify these two implications of the word Veda. Maybe we could think of it as a kind of inspired knowledge, an exhilarating knowledge that's suffused with a feeling of exhilaration and exaltation. Excuse me?
Epiphany, maybe?
I think epiphany maybe is too closely tied to a theistic context, so it might suggest something that's not quite suitable. Okay, so the commentary also explains this word Veda to mean knowledge accompanied by joy. So he's gaining knowledge of the Dhamma, but also experiencing the joy of the Dhamma. Joy, knowledge, and joy in the meaning and in the teaching. And then this leads into what is here translated gladness. But again, gladness is, I think, too weak a word. It's pamoja, which would be maybe better translated joy or even exhilaration. Exhilaration connected with the Dhamma. So when he is exhilarated, then there arises in him rapture. Here the word rapture, this is the Pali word piti. It's a fine, very uplifting type of joy. So we might even translate this elation. Elate is a joy or rapture that's accompanied by a sense of elation. And then when this rapture is developed, then the body and the mind settle down and become tranquil. And then one whose body and mind have become tranquil experiences sukha, which is translated pleasure. This is not the sensual pleasure, but this is a very refined inner pleasure, or even we could maybe render this as bliss. And then one who feels pleasure or who experiences this bliss, the mind becomes concentrated. Here the verb used, samadhiyati, is connected to the noun samadhi. So we have here a sequence that begins with unwavering confidence in the Buddha. And so the noble disciple will, in meditation, take the Buddha, the Dhamma, the Sangha as the objects of meditation. And then by focusing on the Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha, a kind of inspiration, an inspired knowledge will arise in him. And this will give rise or be accompanied by this feeling of gladness or exhilaration. And then as this exhilaration is developed, it will evolve into rapture, an uplifting joy, a sense of elation. The elation, as it's developed, will lead to a settling down or calming down of the body and mind, focused on either the Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha as object. Through the settling of the mind, then this inner feeling of pleasure or blissfulness will arise, this kind of tranquil, like a stream of cool bliss pouring into the mind. And as this, the mind is suffused by this feeling of cool bliss, then it becomes settled and well focused on its object, so that it enters into samadhi. Okay, so this is kind of samadhi is developed based on the Buddha, based on the Dhamma, based on the recollection of the Sangha, and based on the consideration that one has, or the reflection that one has abandoned, at least in part, these defilements of the mind. Okay, now the Buddha makes in paragraph 12 a statement that's a little difficult to understand in this context. But he says, if a bhikkhu of such virtue, such dhamma, which the commentary explains as concentration, and such wisdom eats alms food consisting of excellent hill rice, along with various sauces and curries, even that will be no obstacle for him. Then again he brings in the simile of the cloth. Just as a cloth that is defiled or stained becomes pure and bright with the help of clear water, or just as gold becomes pure and bright with the help of a furnace, so too, if a monk of such virtue, concentration, and wisdom eats this delicious alms food, there will be no obstacle for him. I have to say, the simile here seems out of place. It doesn't really work in relation to the thing it's being compared to. Somehow, it seems to me that in the oral transmission of the sutta, the simile got detached from its original position. It seems that the simile works better in relation to maybe paragraph 8 about him giving up, expelling, releasing, abandoning, and relinquishing these defilements of the mind. Okay, but the way I would understand the example here of, or the case here of the monk who's able to eat this alms food without it being an obstacle to him, the text seems to be suggesting that the monk under consideration could have gone through his practice up to the stage of non-returner. Because the non-returner is one who has completely eliminated sensual desire, that is, desire for any attractive objects of the five physical senses. And so the non-returner can eat delicious alms food, and he'll have no craving for that alms food. He'll have no gratification in the taste of the alms food. But it will just be, he'll just use the alms food, even if it's very delicious, just use it with an understanding that this food is for the purpose of sustaining and supporting the body and for continuing to live the spiritual life. Okay, now the Buddha is going to show how this monk progresses further beyond the stage of a trainer, or of a trainee, one who's still in training, to the stage of an arhat. And the way the monk does this is by developing the samadhi to a particular deep level of concentration, and then using that samadhi as the basis for further development of wisdom. The particular approach to samadhi that's being taught in this sutta is the development of samadhi based on the four Brahmaviharas. These are the four divine abodes, or the four sublime states. And I prepared a table which gives some analysis of the four sublime states. Has everybody gotten a copy of the table? Anybody didn't get it? If anybody didn't get it, then just raise your hand. Okay, so everybody has it, so we can take a look at the four divine abodes. Okay, each of these qualities has its own specific definition, its own specific meaning, and it's also said to have what is called a near enemy and a far enemy. The near enemy is a quality which is similar, superficially it's similar to that of the divine abode. And for that reason, the near enemy is somewhat dangerous. It's a little bit like somebody who really is intent on harming you, but he appears as a friend who comes and says, let me help you, let me be of assistance to you, but the person wants to get close to you in order to injure you or to undermine your well-being. The far enemy is the quality that is directly opposed to the divine quality. And so the far enemy is the type of mental state that it is the purpose of the divine quality to overcome and eliminate. So the first of the four divine abodes is metta, or loving kindness. And the specific quality or nature of loving kindness is the wish for the well-being and happiness of all beings. And so when one develops loving kindness as a meditation, then one extends to others the wish, may these beings be well, may these beings be happy. Sometimes one can amplify this in various ways. May they be peaceful, may they be healthy, may all of their good wishes be fulfilled. Okay, so this is metta, or loving kindness. Then the near enemy of loving kindness, let's take the far enemy first. The far enemy of loving kindness is ill will, hatred, resentment. And so we develop loving kindness in order to overcome ill will. And if ill will comes into the mind, then it will overpower loving kindness. And so we have to develop loving kindness as a way of strengthening the mind in this wish for the well-being and happiness of others. So if others treat us in mean and cruel ways, if others try to harm us, then we won't feel any ill will or resentment towards them. But we will continue to wish for their well-being and happiness. OK, Okay, so ill will is the far enemy of loving kindness, but the near enemy is attachment. It's a kind of worldly love based on one's personal relationship to the other person. This doesn't mean that one shouldn't feel loving kindness towards other people who are close to you, or that you shouldn't have any personal affection for them. But when one is developing loving kindness, and then one thinks of a person who is a close friend or a close relative, then it's very easy for that feeling of worldly attachment to creep in the disguise of loving kindness. So you think you're developing loving kindness towards that person, but what is substituting for loving kindness is the natural, sort of deeply ingrained, instinctual feeling of personal affection and attachment based on your close relationship for that person. So it could be a husband towards his wife, the wife towards the husband, parents towards the child, a brother towards his brother, a sister towards sister, and so on. And so this is why in the normal sequence that's taught in texts like the Visuddhimagga, the normal sequence in developing loving kindness, we don't begin with a person who's very close to us, but first one begins with oneself, then one begins with a dear and respected person, like a teacher or benefactor or mentor. And then after one succeeds in developing loving kindness towards the benefactor, then one takes the close and dear person. Because it's through developing loving kindness towards the benefactor that one has a person with whom one has a positive relationship, and so it's relatively easy to arouse the loving kindness. But because this person is not related so closely to you, you can experience the distinct flavor of loving kindness without confusing it with this attachment and this kind of a clinging related to personal affection. Okay, the second divine abode, or divine quality, is compassion. Now, loving kindness is taken to be the foundation for all four of the divine abodes, because loving kindness extends the wish for the well-being and happiness universally to all beings. But as one is extending loving kindness towards all beings, one will see that some of the beings one is extending the loving kindness towards are afflicted with suffering. So then after one develops the loving kindness to a certain degree of strength, strong enough to serve as a foundation, one can then focus in on those people, those beings who are undergoing suffering. And as one does so, when it feels the heart stirred, shaken, aroused, even broken by the suffering of others. And that quality, that trembling of the heart with other beings who are undergoing suffering, is what is meant by karuna, compassion. And so it is said that the specific meaning of compassion is empathy with the suffering of others, or maybe empathy with those who are undergoing suffering. Empathy, the word literally means feeling with, so that one feels with those who are undergoing suffering. But it doesn't mean that you yourself become miserable, upset, or afflicted. But it's actually accompanied by an inner rewarding feeling. It's a feeling that one enjoys because it involves the opening of the heart and the breaking down of the barriers of the heart. But the specific aspect that it's focusing on is the suffering of other beings. And so the tendency of compassion is to move one towards action intended to remove the suffering of others. So this is why the Visuddhimagga says that compassion promotes the aspect of removing suffering. The direct opposite of compassion, the far enemy, is cruelty, or the Pali word vihingsa or vihesa means that mental that motivation of the mind that moves one to inflict suffering on others, the drive to harm and injure others. And so a person with compassion will never think of harming others, but will always want to do anything possible to remove the suffering of others. Okay, the near enemy, what's called the near enemy of compassion, is worldly grief. This is the grief that arises when one hears that somebody who is dear and beloved to oneself has undergone a certain type of suffering, that they're ill, that they've been injured, that they're in trouble or difficulty. Then there arises, it could be worry, concern, grief, a sense of misery. But that grief or misery, though one thinks it's an altruistic feeling, but if we examine it closely, we'll see that it's really a self-referential feeling. One is grief-stricken because this person is dear to me. This is my beloved son, my beloved daughter, my beloved brother or sister. And so when they are in trouble, then one feels agitated and distressed because it's someone who is dear to myself. When one has true compassion, let's say a highly developed level of compassion, then when one hears about the suffering of those who are dear to oneself, one won't be grief-stricken, but one will still be concerned. But it's the concern which arises from a true wish to eliminate their suffering, not from the feeling that I will be deprived of somebody who's loved by myself. Okay, then the third divine quality, again it arises based on loving kindness, but this is the quality that arises when we learn about the good fortune, the success, or good qualities of others. This quality is called in Pali mudita, which is based on the word or the verb mudita, which means to feel joy. So just taken by itself, mudita could be understood simply as joy. But when we take it in the context of the four Brahmaviharas, we see it has to be a kind of joy that is based on knowing about the success or good fortune of others. So when we see that others succeed, that others meet with good fortune, when we see that others have good qualities, worthy qualities, then instead of feeling envious and competitive and a sense of rivalry, then there arises joy and happiness in the heart. Joy and happiness for others who are blessed with the success and good fortune. And it's said in the commentaries that the opposite of mudita is aversion or discontent. So it seems to me that the real opposite of altruistic joy is envy. That is, when others succeed, when others display some virtuous qualities, one resents their success, and then one feels envy on that account. And then the near enemy is what is called worldly joy. And this is the joy that arises maybe because somebody who is close to you has achieved success. And then you're rejoicing, not because of this kind of detached joy for the other person, but you're joyful because that is one's beloved, dear and beloved, wife, husband, son, daughter, brother, sister, whatever. Okay, now compassion and altruistic joy move the mind in a certain way. Compassion sort of shakes the mind, shakes the heart, can make the heart tremble. And mudita, altruistic joy, can cause this elation or uplifting of the heart. And so to perfect them, one has to develop the fourth divine abode, divine quality. This is called upeka, which is equanimity. Now, equanimity here doesn't mean that one gives up compassion and altruistic joy in order to become cold and indifferent, but rather it's the development of a mind of impartiality towards being. And the ability to sort of step back from one's involvement in the suffering and good fortune of others and to look upon them with a mind that cannot be shaken, so that one can still experience the compassion, still experience the altruistic joy, but because one has developed this equanimity, the mind remains calm, composed, always well-balanced. And so it's said in the commentaries that upeka has the particular aspect or characteristic of impartiality towards living beings, looking upon all beings as the same, without discrimination or distinctions. And then the far enemy of upeka is attachment to some and resentment or ill will towards others. So both of these show that the mind is not perfectly balanced. It's the mind is swinging towards one extreme in relation to those who are dear, towards the other extreme in relation to those who are hostile to oneself. So that is the far enemy. And the near enemy of upeka is dull indifference or apathy. That's complete lack of concern for others, or kind of complacency, just being satisfied with one's own well-being and success, but not caring about others. Okay, so these are the four divine abodes. If there's any questions about them, please feel welcome to ask.
Where does Schadenfreude fit? Is it more like the foreign enemy ill will?
What is what?
Schadenfreude, that is delight in someone else's injury or pain. Without having cause.
Is that a German word?
Yeah. I mean Freude is pleasure.
Yeah, Freude, yeah.
It's pleasure in sorrow. Like it's a German, it's a large German theme in literature and philosophy. Right. But you know, taking pleasure in someone else's suffering. It's a feeling when someone hears that someone else has been injured or yeah. sick or something like that, feeling satisfied by that.
Yeah, happy with that. Yeah.
Is that more like ill will, or is it more in the category of aversion and discontent and envy, or the foreign enemy of altruistic joy?
That seems to me to be closer to the far, to be something like the far enemy of compassion.
Of compassion.
Even though cruelty, the word that's used here is cruelty.
Yeah.
But if you would take delight, of course cruelty or injured harmfulness implies that you yourself are inflicting the harm on others.
Yeah.
But I think it could also have a wider meaning, even of taking pleasure in knowing that others are undergoing suffering.
Okay, fine, thanks.
I think if worldly attachment based upon person or relationship is considered as the near enemy to loving kindness, why does the Metta Sutta teach us that one should develop loving kindness just like a mother towards her only child?
That one should give up what?
One should give up loving kindness as a mother towards her only child. So one start develops with the enemy and then transform the enemy into
it would seem to me that one can begin by developing a kind of, okay, maybe this is the point, that one should develop the, don't forget it says, evampi sabba bhutesu manasam bhavaya parimana, that one develops the mind of loving kindness towards all beings. So one uses the kind of love that the mother has towards the only child as the example of the kind of love that one should develop, but one has to develop that love towards all living beings. But it's just an example that's used in the sutta, maybe to be poetic. But also I want to just add here that one shouldn't think from the fact that, okay, it said that attachment is the near enemy of loving kindness. So if you're married, you women shouldn't think from now on, I'm not even going to say hello to my husband in the morning. If he comes into the kitchen, I'm just going to remain silent. And if I meet him out in the street, I'll just pass him by like he was a stranger. And the husband shouldn't say, therefore, I'm not going to show any special kindness towards my wife. And if you have children, I'm not going to help my children in any way. Why should I help my child rather than help the children of others? So I just treat all children the same with complete indifference. Let them fare for themselves. Let them cook their own meals. Why should I cook for them? No, I think within the context of your day-to-day life, still have to show affection and treat your husband, wife, children with some kind of special kindness. But it just means that when one is practicing metta as a meditative discipline, that one should be careful not to mistake that feeling of attachment for the feeling of loving kindness.
Bhakti, you mentioned the compassion, the heart trembling, and the altruistic joy, the heart filled with joy, and then the balance and equanimity.
Yeah.
Is there a quality of the heart that you would describe for metta?
You know, the way I would describe the quality of metta, I'd say it's the mind suffused with this real wish for the well-being and happiness of others. It's difficult to think of a metaphorical quality, the way you think of the heart trembling for compassion, uplifted with joy, but maybe it's almost like a kind of pushing quality in the heart. Pushing out or suffusing that wish for the well-being and happiness of others. Maybe a radiating quality in the heart.
Thank you.
Speaking as I'm a mother,
yeah,
with an only child,
mm,
it seems as I get older and as I practice that at moments, at least, the attachment,
yeah,
that I feel for my daughter, my self-referential wish for her happiness in my terms, can give way to moments of metta.
Can give way?
Yes.
Yeah.
That the near enemy can almost be an object for me as a worldling.
Yeah.
I can take attachment itself, and at moments it can be refined or,
yeah,
open up,
yeah,
into metta.
Yeah, I think that's definitely the case. And so, when one is developing metta, this doesn't mean that one shouldn't take the people who are dear and close to oneself as objects of metta. Because even within the normal sequence of the persons that one chooses, according to the method of Visuddhimagga, one does take a dear and close person, and it can be one's own child. But as one is practicing, one has to be able to distinguish, is this a feeling of sort of natural, instinctual, maternal attachment to the daughter, or am I really developing loving kindness towards her? And as one goes on with the practice of metta, then one gets a clearer sense of what is the distinctive flavor or the felt tone of loving-kindness. And so then one can replace the sort of clinging feeling of attachment with the genuine feeling of loving-kindness, even towards those who are very close and dear to oneself. Okay, I'll just take one more question, then the question from the internet. Then I want to go on and finish the sutta today.
Not really a question, but just my experience of it, I think that the impermanence, and you know, that always is in the back of my mind as far as the clinging, because you can't really cling to something that's impermanent. So that always, like with my metta, that kind of like my stabilizing thing.
Okay, that's a good observation, but that is sort of bringing in the aspect of wisdom in order to sort of cool off the attachment that might.
But yet there's a very warm-hearted quality to it.
There's a very what?
Warm-hearted, like the metta.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, yeah. Okay, then let me just take the internet question. Okay, he says, in the Brahma-Vihara table, is the far enemy the object of vanquishment, maybe relinquishment with proper practice, and the near enemy the danger of unskillful practice? Yeah, I think that's a good way to put it, that the far enemy is the quality that one has to overcome through the practice of the four sublime, the four divine abodes. And the near enemy are qualities that resemble the four divine abodes that will come in and disguise themselves. They'll come in the disguise of the four divine abodes. So that one is actually, if one is not aware of this danger, then one might take them to be the divine abodes, and one neglects the development of the true divine qualities. Okay, I want to go on now in order to finish the sutta. So, okay, the text explains how one develops the four divine abodes. It takes each one separately. It says, he pervades one quarter with a mind imbued with loving kindness, the second, the third, the fourth, so above, below, around, and everywhere. So this is pervading now the four directions with the mind of loving kindness. This is actually beginning at a relatively advanced stage in the practice. Normally, according to the traditional method, we begin with specific persons. We begin with oneself, then a dear but respected person, like a teacher or a benefactor, then a close person, like a close friend, then a neutral or indifferent person, then a hostile person. And as one practices, one has to be able to develop loving kindness towards all of these people, ideally with the same intensity. Then after one succeeds in developing loving kindness to all of these persons, then one can move on to extend the loving kindness, to expand it. This is done by using wider and wider geographical regions. For example, if I'm practicing here in this hall with all of you, then I will meditate, may all of the people in this hall be well and happy. May they all be peaceful, all be healthy. Then I will go on, I might go on to take everybody who's in Zhuangyan Monastery, same wish, then to have a large group. I could take everybody in New York City, then I might take everybody in North America, then I will go through the continents, North America, South America, Europe, Africa, Asia, Australia, until I'm extending loving kindness to the whole world. Then I will take the directions, until I'm able to pervade the whole world with the mind of loving kindness, abundant, exalted, immeasurable, without hostility, and without ill will. I'm going to start experiencing a little ill will in a moment. Okay, then this is done the same with compassion, altruistic joy, equanimity. So each one has its own specific differences in the method, but I won't go into the differences in method right here. Okay, so now the practice of the four Brahmaviharas in this way brings the attainment of a deep level of samadhi. But now based on the samadhi, the Buddha is going to show how the meditator will develop wisdom or insight in order to gain liberation, the fourth and final stage of realization. So he says, he understands, it's rather cryptic, this formula. He understands thus, there is this. He understands thus, there is the inferior, or what is low. There is the superior, what is excellent. And beyond, there is an escape from this whole field of perception. Okay, what is being stated here, though it's a bit obscure, is the Four Noble Truths. So he understands, thus there is this. The word this is referring to the five aggregates. Now what the meditator does after, say, attaining the samadhi based on loving kindness, he'll withdraw from the samadhi and then look back reflectively upon this mind that has been in the samadhi of loving kindness. And he'll see in that mind of loving kindness, or in that state of loving kindness, there is the physical body present. That is the aggregate of material form. In the state of samadhi, there is a particular feeling. There is a particular perception. There are particular mental formations or volitions. And there is consciousness. So in this way, the meditator has taken that experience of samadhi and dissected it in terms of the five aggregates. And then he sees that these five aggregates are impermanent. They were in one condition in the state of samadhi. When he comes out of the samadhi, they're in a different condition. And he looks upon the five aggregates as being subject to constant arising and passing away. In other words, they're impermanent. And because they're impermanent, they are unsatisfactory, or dukkha. And because they're impermanent and bound up with dukkha, with suffering, they should not be taken to be I and mine, to be a self. So in other words, he's seeing the five aggregates that were involved in the experience of samadhi as being impermanent, bound up with dukkha, with suffering, and as being non-self. So he's gaining insight into the three characteristics of the five aggregates, and this brings one to the understanding of the noble truth of suffering. Then he investigates these five aggregates in terms of their origination, and he sees that these five aggregates originate from craving, but from craving and ignorance. And so that is what is meant by there is the inferior. The Pali word is hinang, what is low, what is, you know, defective or inferior. And so this is the craving, ignorance, and other defilements that from life to life bring the five aggregates into being. Then there is the superior. The Pali word here is panitam, what is excellent or sublime. And this I take to be a reference to the third noble truth, the noble truth of the cessation of suffering, or nibbana. And then the text says, beyond there is an escape from the whole field of perception. So this I take to be the reference to the Noble Eightfold Path, which is the way that leads out from everything bound up with perception, ideation, conceptualization. So in this way, the disciple is gaining realization of the Four Noble Truths. And then the text continues in the standard way, when he knows and sees thus, his mind is liberated from the taint, that's the asava of sensual desire, from the taint of being or craving from existence, and from the taint of ignorance. When it is liberated, there comes the knowledge, it's liberated. He understands birth is destroyed, the holy life has been lived, what had to be done has been done. There is no coming back to any state of being. Okay, so this passage shows through this knowledge or insight into the Four Noble Truths, the mind is liberated from the asavas, and one achieves the fourth and final stage of enlightenment, the stage of arhatship. And then the Buddha says, he adds one sentence here that is not typical of this kind of passage. And the commentary explains the reason why the Buddha added that sentence. In the audience, he saw a Brahmin who believed that purification is to be achieved through ritualistic bathing. This was the common belief of the Brahmins, that the way to purify oneself of one's defilements and bad karma from the past is to go to the sacred rivers and bathe. Even the Hindus today often believe that to purify oneself, one has to go before one dies to the river Ganges and bathe in the river Ganges, and the water from the Ganges will clean off all of one's sins and bad karma from the past. So the Buddha knew that if he uttered the statement, the Brahmin will come forward and engage him in a conversation, and then the Buddha would answer him in the appropriate way, and the Brahmin would gain faith in the Buddha, ask to become a monk, and then practice and achieve arhatship. Okay, so the Buddha said, this monk is called one who is bathed with the inner bathing. But when he said this, the Brahmin thought, what is the Buddha speaking about? Doesn't he go to the famous holy rivers for bathing? And so the Brahmin asked this, and then the Buddha says, what is the point of going to the Bahuka River? What can the Bahuka River do? Actually, the name Bahuka River means the river of many, probably because many people went there to bathe. So then the Brahmin explains, the Bahuka River is held by many to give liberation. It is held by many to give merit. And many wash away their bad karma, their evil actions, in the Bahuka River. Okay, then when the Brahmin said that, then the Buddha replied to him using in verses. He says, what is the point of going to these holy rivers? A foolish person might go there and bathe forever, but that's not going to purify his bad karma. But one pure in heart has evermore the feast of spring, the holy day, one fair in action, one pure in heart brings his virtue to perfection. It is here, O Brahman, that you should bathe to make yourself a refuge for all beings. If you speak no falsehood, harm no living beings, take not what is not offered, and with faith and free from avarice, what need for you to go to Gaia? Gaia was a place of pilgrimage for, with a holy river. For any well will be your Gaia. Okay, then when the Buddha said this, the Brahmin expressed his appreciation. He took refuge in the three jewels, and then he went forth under the Buddha and became a monk, and went alone to practice, into solitude to practice, and then he achieved the final goal of the holy life, the achievement of arhatship, and then he directly knew birth is destroyed, the holy life has been lived, what had to be done has been done, there is no more coming back to any state of being, and he became one of the arhats. Okay, that is the end of the sutta. I think I'll have to go now to take the lunch. And so if you have any questions, we're going to have a discussion period right after lunch, so just about 12 o'clock, a few minutes after 12. So please just hold your questions and come back for the discussion period. If you wish, you can go to take lunch as well. Just for the next class, next week there will be a retreat going on, so we won't have a class next week, but we'll have the next class on January 2nd. Is that all right? Because it's right after the New Year. I don't know if people go on extended New Year vacations. Does anybody have trouble with that date? Okay, it seems to be okay, so we'll have it for the next class, January 2nd. And that day I'll take Sutta number 8 of the Majjhima Nikaya. With this we go from 16 mental defilements to 44 types of corruptions of body, speech, and mind. Okay, we'll end with the sharing of the merits. Okay, to share the merits of listening to Dhamma, speaking on Dhamma, with the Devas, the Buddhas, the fierce spirits, and with all beings. Akasata Jabumata Deva Naga Mahidika Punyantang Anumodipa Chirang Rakantu Sasanam Akasata Jabumata Deva Naga Mahidika Punyantang Anumodipa Chirang Rakantu Desanam Akasata Jabumata Deva Naga Mahidika Punyantang Anumoditva Chirang Rakantu Mangparang Etavataja Amhehi Sampadang Punya Sampadang Sabe Deva Numodantu Sabe Bhutanumodantu Sabe Satanumodantu Sabha Sampati Siddhya. Okay, since many of you I won't see until the beginning of the next year, and let me wish you all a happy holiday season and a happy and healthy new year. Okay, we'll end with the three half bows.
Thank you.